Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
As some of you may know, I'm a chaplain in Manhattan, and currently I'm a full-time staff chaplain at Mount Sinai Beth Israel in the East Village. When I was still a chaplain resident, that is, a chaplain in training at Mount Sinai Hospital in the Upper East Side, I received a referral to visit a patient before he had a scheduled surgery. And he's one of those patients that has stuck in my mind ever since. I'm not sure if he asked for a chaplain or someone noticed that he was anxious or depressed. He was on a regular floor devoted to heart patients. The referral sheet listed him as a Mr. John Aholele. That's a pseudonym, 64 years old, and Mormon. Clearly, Mormon missionaries had made it to Polynesia. When I arrived, Mr. Aholele was seated in a chair, and the other bed in the room was temporarily empty. He was a lean 64-year-old man with a beard, curly hair, and dark golden skin. His appearance, along with his name, made me think that he was perhaps Hawaiian or Polynesian. His heart surgery was scheduled for 2 days later. When I asked him how he was doing, he said, "I am in a wonderful peace because I have put my faith in the One." He said that before that, he was, quote, "filled with worry, a wreck with worry for a week before today." I asked him what changed. He said, "Yesterday, everything changed. I just put my faith in God, and now I feel very relaxed." We talked, and I learned that John, I'll call him John, explained that his surgery was to put in a pump. He said, "The pump is to keep me alive until I can get a transplant." He explained, "They say it's an 18 to 20 month wait on average for a new heart. With my blood type, maybe a little more. I am having this now because of the mistake I made." He spoke of this mistake with a tone of self-recrimination, even disgust with himself. "What was that mistake?" I asked. John said, "Inaction. In 2010, I procrastinated." He explained, "I didn't supply all the information that was necessary, which I could have done with very little work. I was perfectly capable of doing it. And due to my own negligence, I didn't get the insurance clearance. So now I'm 6 years older, and what would have been a $250,000 procedure is now $1 million procedure. Because of some technicalities that I could have easily dealt with, the surgery didn't happen. I could have had this done 6 years ago. There was a bed for me, and the doctors were waiting, and I didn't come." He shook his head with disgust. John explained it much more thoroughly than I've rendered the conversation. It was full of technical details that I can't possibly remember and didn't understand even then. Even though he told the story in a flat tone, his rage and contempt for himself was palpable. The weight of it was heavy, even just for me, a listener. Finally, after his long explanation, I said to John, "Can you forgive yourself?" John tossed off casually, "Oh, I know I am forgiven." I said, "God has forgiven you, But have you forgiven yourself? There was a long pause. Finally, John said, "No, I haven't forgiven myself." I asked, "What stands in the way of forgiving yourself?" An even longer silence followed. And when he spoke, John didn't answer my question. He gave a rueful laugh and he mused, "God gives us so many gifts all our life, and we just drop them, gift after gift." I answered, "Yes, but he keeps giving them." John repeated, "Yes, he keeps giving them." I said, "What a wonderful description of what it means to be human." I was referring to what I see as the human condition, one of continual flaws and mistakes, yet continual hope, and if we're lucky, opportunities for change. John continued, "We look back when we are in our 50s and 60s and we see the gifts that we were given and dropped when we were young and we wasted them. And then finally we see. Maybe that's why there was only one Mozart, one Guggenheim, one Frank Lloyd Wright. Maybe there is some young boy who is given the gift of being a Frank Lloyd Wright and he drops it and never knows what he could have become. While if we took all those gifts, there is no limit to what we could become." I responded, "Maybe that is what it is to be human. For if we took all the gifts we are offered, it sounds like we could be infinite. And we are only humans, not gods." John grinned and said, "Yes." I asked John, "What gifts were you given?" And he said that before retirement, he had been an economist. I asked, "What did you do with that gift?" John said calmly, "I wasted it. I only worked in finance. You see, I never taught. I was too greedy." He paused. "But that's a small mistake, one that is easily forgiven." I wondered if John ever gave himself credit for not wasting a gift. So I asked him, "What gifts were you given that you did not drop?" John thought and then spoke slowly with difficulty. He said, "One gift that I was given was my wife. She died 8 years ago." "I'm so sorry," I said. John added, "We had 30 years together, 30 years of happiness." I looked at John and said, "So you did not waste that gift." John responded, "No, I did not waste that gift." He began to cry. "And I still miss her," he said, "to this day." There was a bit more to the visit, but this is the part that stays with me. And several things strike me about it. One was John's powerful metaphor of the gifts we are given that we either drop or hold on to, and if we hold them, realize to fruition. That led to the question I asked John, "What gifts did you drop, and what gifts did you keep?" Another thing that struck me was the starkness of John's notion of gifts. For him, they are clear and recognizable, and in the fullness of time, we will notice if we drop them. This raises the question, what constitutes a gift? And do we always know it when we see it? And then finally, I look at how harshly John condemned himself for not getting that heart transplant earlier, and his refusal to forgive himself for that. You might even say that as a believer, he had the hubris to not forgive himself, even though God had forgiven him. Where was his understanding and compassion for himself? While asking which gifts John or any particular person dropped and didn't drop is not a particularly thoughtful or philosophical question, in my visit with John, it was a tool to get him to talk more about himself so that I could see how he felt about his life at this critical juncture. Did he feel he'd had blessings that he'd been smart or lucky enough to accept? Or was he equally hard on himself or bitter about every sphere of his life? I learned that he saw himself as dropping the gift of his intellect by choosing a career in finance rather than academia, but that he didn't think that was that important. He saw his wife as a tremendous gift, one that he did not waste, one that was much more important than his career choice. The question of what gifts were given and whether we drop or keep them captured my imagination. And I started to ask friends and family members the same question I had asked John. What gifts did you drop? What gifts did you hold on to? And it wasn't long before this question of gifts got more complicated than John's stark vision. As I asked earlier, what is a gift? Well, that one's not too hard. I think of it as any talent, opportunity, or relationship, anything we would think of as a blessing in our lives. A deeper question is whose responsibility is it to ensure that a gift of potential or talent is realized? How much power do we have in choosing to accept the gifts we are given? John said, maybe there is some young boy who is given the gift of being a Frank Lloyd Wright and he drops it and never knows what he could have been. Exactly. How many people are born in poverty or suffering and never even get the education or opportunity to understand or know the gifts they've been given? That's certainly true of talents or aptitudes and also opportunities. Many of us were given the gift of families with enough means or parents that valued our development so that we could identify and nurture our talents. Imagine if Beethoven or Ella Fitzgerald had never had the opportunity to blossom. And of course, the fact is, there are millions of Beethovens and Ella Fitzgeralds whose talents are never allowed to blossom. This is our human tragedy. Our personal limitations, our social and political limitations, economic limitations, ultimately, simply our mortality. Even if we turned back the clock on the 2016 election, the Syrian civil war, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, every war and every famine in the world. And even if we suddenly spread the wealth more equally and eradicated poverty, it would be a comparative paradise. But it would still be our condition as humans to be finite, imperfect, have accidents, and drop gifts. More compelling is the question, how do we know when a gift is a gift? A wise friend of mine said, you can't always tell what's a gift. And she told me a well-worn story about the old Jewish farmer whose son breaks his leg. Everyone is crying, woe, woe is me. But the next day, The Russians came recruiting soldiers, and he was spared because of that broken leg. Furthermore, you may be given a gift in your 20s, and you may not be ready to appreciate it. Sometimes it recurs or comes to fruition later. And something you regret, a gift dropped or lost, you may look back on and see in a different way. My friend Holly said, "I have come to think the essence of resilience is being open to the fact that things that happen in your life and you can't, things happen in your life and you can't see where your life will go. You can judge events or choices only in hindsight." She gave me the example of her own career. I remember when Holly started out as a physician, as an intern in obstetrics and gynecology. She loved delivering babies and working in women's health. However, it was such an exhausting and demanding program, 100 hours a week easily, that she gave it up. I'm sure it felt like a real loss and maybe even a failure. Instead, she became a dermatologic surgeon, which she describes as work that fits me so well, that I passionately love, that is perfect for me. She's thought, what if I had found an easier OBGYN program and never discovered this work that I love so much? You may be thinking the same thing that I thought. Well, you might have loved that too. There's more than one right career match or love match, I believe, and thank heaven for that. It's the other side of the limitations life puts on us, our ability to take advantage of many different possibilities. But Holly's on to something. She has the gift of turning tragedies and losses into possibilities, new gifts. For example, her husband has been losing his sight for years. Now he's reached the point where he has to use a white cane to find his way around. She said to him, "Yes, it's too bad we can't go to plays or movies anymore. But we'll go to lectures, and we'll still have concerts." Another thing I learned in talking to friends and family is that what may look to outsiders like a gift that someone wasted may be a different gift to the receiver. My mother reflected on the gifts she'd been given that she'd dropped or not dropped. The first thing that occurred to her was her talent as a pianist. Throughout her high school years, her parents sacrificed both time and money to drive her from tiny Livonia, New York, to the big city, Rochester, an hour away, so that she could take piano lessons every Saturday on scholarship at the famous Eastman School of Music. At the time, it was a great gift in expected and unexpected ways. Her gift was not a virtuoso technique, but great musical sensitivity. Not only did she develop that gift, but her piano lessons gave her other unexpected gifts. As an unhappy student at her high school, teased mercilessly because her father was the principal, she got one day out of town in the big city. She got to feel special. She got to travel and accompany singers and other musicians on the piano, meet new people, and have her talents recognized. Well, unfortunately, she did not get another critical gift: the love of practicing. And furthermore, she was terribly anxious whenever she had to perform. I can remember when she was the choir accompanist at the UU church where I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Every Sunday morning that she had to play, she was literally sick to her stomach. Her anxiety was an unwelcome gift from an anxious and neurotic mother. So when she turned down a full college scholarship to study piano at Eastman in favor of home economics at Cornell, her parents thought she had taken her gift and dropped it. They felt that way for the rest of their lives. But my mother didn't feel that way at all. What to her parents was a gift squandered was a gift that she didn't drop. It opened the doors to many other gifts. It gave her a love of music that literally shaped her life. She met my father because his sister, a singer whom my mother accompanied, told him to call her up, knowing they had a shared love of music. She said to me, "Look at my life, the symphony, the opera, chamber music." And it's true, she and my father built a life filled with music, as symphony and opera goers, as singers and choruses, and as devoted, which to me at the time as a kid seemed never-ending, listeners to recorded classical music. Believe me, if it was Saturday afternoon, it was the Metropolitan Opera on the radio, and it was booming throughout the house. So sometimes the nature of the gifts we are given isn't clear. What may have appeared as the gift of talent in piano performance for my mother became the love of music and all the ways that can enrich one's life. And I mentioned earlier, the third and last thing that really struck me in my conversation with John, the patient, was how harshly John condemned himself for not getting that heart transplant earlier. Clearly, it was a mistake and a dumb one. But he refused to forgive himself for it. I was struck with his incredible lack of compassion for himself. I didn't hear him probing for the reasons that he procrastinated. If he had, he might have made some interesting discoveries that would help explain the reasons for that choice. How many of us, I wonder, have made choices or non-choices for which we won't forgive ourselves? Another friend of mine, with whom I was talking about this subject, went through a deeply traumatic divorce when she was in her 30s. I remember her talking about her husband when they were dating. She adored everything about him, even though they had very different backgrounds and tastes. In other words, they really weren't compatible for the long haul. But he was very good looking, athletic, and had been very popular in high school. Now, they met in their mid or early 20s, so high school wasn't that much earlier. Although classically pretty, Anne had been very insecure and felt she didn't fit in high school. Ben, on the other hand, and this is almost impossible to believe, but true, he literally had to choose, because it was the same night, between being the lead in the senior class play and playing in the final game of the high school basketball championship for the state of California. Now, you can see the attraction for Anne. She projected all her deepest adolescent wishes and fantasies on Ben and downplayed their very real differences. Finally, he asked her to marry him. Just a year and a half later, he left. I have never seen a more traumatic divorce than that divorce was for Anne. For her, it was right back to high school, and the rejection was confirmed. Even though she remarried a more appropriate partner 5 years later, she was still scarred. She dreamed about Ben, bad dreams. She never forgave him at that time. A part of her reverted to high school whenever she ran into him, and I was dismayed by the immaturity she displayed. She would crow to me if he looked bad or if he looked older. She was reverting to the values and maturity level of an adolescent. But years later, when I talked with Anne, long after her second marriage, she said to me that she realized not only had she not forgiven Ben, she had not forgiven herself for making the wrong choice based on what she now recognized were childish needs and insecurities. And she hadn't forgiven herself for bearing some responsibility for the breakup. Why would her husband want to be idolized based on a fantasy, one that could burst like a balloon anytime she finally saw him as the real and flawed person that he was? Given the destructiveness of their divorce, I can understand her self-blame and even shame at her immaturity, shame reinvigorated by all her old insecurities. But Anne had learned to forgive herself for being imperfect. In other words, for being human. She had compassion for herself, and thank heaven even for Ben, saying, "I'm just a human being, and I was wrong. We all have insecurities." John, so enraged at himself for putting off that heart transplant, could learn something from Anne. I wonder, maybe he has forgiven himself by now. When I ended my visit, John asked me for a prayer. In that prayer, and by the way, in my prayers, I often try and send a message or reflect what I've heard that that person needs. So in that prayer, I gave thanks for the gifts of serenity and compassion, and sometimes compassion for oneself. To forgive oneself is a form of maturity that I hope John has realized. Because no matter what we do with our gifts and the opportunities that we've been given, according to the Buddha, in the end, only three things matter: how much you loved, how gently you lived, and how gracefully you let go of things not meant for you. May it be so.